Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Rodenberg, Judge Larkin, Judge Riley, the Honorable John R. Rodenberg presiding.
You may be seated. Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is noteworthy in that it is the anniversary of the adoption of the United States Constitution in 1787. It's Constitution Day. Happy Constitution Day, everyone. First matter on the calendar, and I'm going to check the name, and if I have it wrong, correct me. Gowan?
Gone.
Like, gone. Okay. With that, I think you both know the rules, 15 minutes each, 5 minutes for rebuttal if the appellant wishes to use that time. As you approach the podium, give us your name and the party you represent. We know, but so that it... For
the rebuttal. May it please the court, my name is Eric Cardall. I'm representing Patrick Gowan, the appellant. And we think this is an important case. Minnesota courts will go one way or the other based on the interpretation of 518B.01 subdivision 6A. We believe it may require the court to look at the statute facially and also as applied in the context of this case. As the court knows from the briefs, this appeal is about section 518B.01 OFP extension procedures, stipulated order for protections without findings of fact, respondent due process protections, and of course preserving parent-child relationships. We're always concerned about that. The district court relies on a routine of accepting affidavits in lieu of order for protection extension hearings based on order for protection settlement agreement. I propose to the court that what I call the hermeneutic key.
You call it what?
The hermeneutic key, the way to translate the facts in the law, the entry point, the way the court should view this, is at the time of the extension, the mother had sole custody of a 13 and 15-year-old who had not seen their father for a year, and the father objected. And so if we view the protected persons being the 13 and 15-year-old, the teenagers, then they're beneficiaries or purported beneficiaries of the OFP settlement agreement. So the issue would be, should the children under the statute have to make a showing of reasonable fear of physical harm from the father?
Was that argument made in your brief?
Yes.
The argument you're making now?
Sure. Addendum 56 and 57, Patrick alleges the children did not fear him and that there was no showing of reasonable fear in the court.
Okay, I'm talking about the principal brief.
That there are no showings under the stat, yes.
The principal brief identifies the questions presented as being whether there was error under 518B01 sub 6A for not meeting the procedural requirements. That's what I understood you to be talking
right.
about.
One of the procedural requirements is a showing under 518B.01 subdivision 6A. B, I guess the court may extend the terms of existing order, or if an order is no longer in effect, grant a new order upon a showing that. And then two says the petitioner is reasonably in fear of physical harm from the respondent.
Okay, well, the petitioner is Ms. Gowan.
Right, but the protected persons include the children. So if we look at the stipulated order for protection, the action was brought on behalf of both Ms. Gowan and the children. And so I think that would be addendum.
But you're not claiming that paragraph 23 of that stipulated order is ambiguous, are you?
In the appeal, what we argued was that there's a legislative precondition on the extension of the OFP. And so what I'm suggesting is a way to approach the facts and the law. And one way and I'm trying to help the court understand why we're of the opinion that there has to be a showing that the children are in reasonable fear of harm at the time of the OFP extension. And that's a statutory requirement. And we're saying that because we didn't have a hearing, the statutory requirements were never required to be showed. So regardless of whether this court agrees with me, that's important that when you have a order for protection that reaches minor children, that the OFP extension requirement of showing physical harm should be shown. Let's say you disagree with me.
Well, let me quote some language from In re LaBelle. which says that parties are allowed by stipulation to agree to incur certain obligations which the court acting under its statutory authority is not empowered to impose. And so when I read paragraph 23, it seems that the parties agreed by stipulation that notwithstanding the provisions of the statute, petitioner shall have the right at her sole discretion to elect to extend the effective period. Now, obviously, the court couldn't do that, but the parties agreed that petitioner could do it.
Well,
so what do we do with case law, for instance, in Ray LaBelle?
Right, and here, you know, we have the third party, the children or minor children, and what I'm saying is the court can have an opinion or not whether I'm right. That's in the best interest to check at that time, 1 year into it, no visits from the father, whether visitation should be permitted. So is that a wise requirement? I don't know. I mean, I think it is. You may disagree, right? But the point is the legislature made a decision. The legislature made a decision that with respect to extensions, the legislature says we're going to have a hearing to see if the parties subject to the OFP are reasonable fear of harm from the respondent. And that is reasonable for the legislature to have a precondition regarding extension of OFP. I note that the showing is very low for an extension of OFP. It says in the statute, a petitioner does not need to show that physical harm is imminent to obtain extension or a subsequent order under the subdivision. So it's an incredibly low standard, but why did the legislature include a requirement that there be a showing at that moment? And it was to protect not only the respondent, but also children subject to orders for protection. And so our concern is, you know, okay, we understand paragraph 23 is there, but who in the heck, in a situation of a father or, say, a mother, is presented with this, would think that a court would omit the legislative requirement that the children have to be consulted, that an order for extension is based on their reasonable fear of physical harm from the respondent?
I have a more basic question about the lay of the land at the time the parties made the agreement that resulted in that paragraph. At that point in time, had the parties gone ahead with the hearing, do you agree that the district court could have, had it made findings, issued an order for protection for a period of 2 years?
Well, the statute permits up to 2 years, correct?
Correct. Yeah. So the district court, had the parties not made the agreement, the district court had the authority, the subject matter jurisdiction, if you will, to enter an order for up to 2 years, and instead the parties decided on terms and conditions that they apparently agreed to have that 2 year period reduced to one unless the mother filed this affidavit and requested extension. Why is that? Why can't they do that?
Well, the OFP extension has a precondition that if the court's going to sign an order that there have to be a hearing.
Well, but we've already talked about LaBelle. There's also a case called Leifer, where parties can, and they do regularly make agreements that are beyond the scope of what the statute particularly says the court can do. They can't make an agreement to do a thing that the statute prohibits them from doing.
Right, and so our argument is that the statute, the legislative limitation here prohibits the OFP extension being signed by the court without the hearing and the satisfaction of the criteria, which includes a showing that the children are reasonably in fear of physical harm for the respondent. So the statute says, upon application, notice to all parties in hearing, the court may extend the relief granted in existing order for protection. So I think that language means that the predicate for the court extending the relief to an existing order of protection requires application, notice all parties, and hearing.
But was the court really extending the period beyond what the parties had agreed to, or was the court merely effectuating the agreement of the parties to have the OFP last for a period of up to 2 years?
You know, we did a pretty careful job of not focusing on that argument, but focusing on regardless of what the contract says.
I know you didn't focus on that argument. I'm trying to focus you on it now.
And we emphatically disagree that the purpose of the statute is to protect third-party beneficiary child beneficiaries. And so this OFP extension limitation is very important to protecting children. And children upon an OFP extension have very important rights that are affected by the parent with sole custody's decision. So the parent with sole custody here made a decision to extend the OFP. The legislative limitation here is intended to protect the children because they don't have a voice.
Except your client went to family court, as I understand it. I'm reading at page 6 of the district court's order. Respondent attempted to change the legal custody established in the OFP by filing a motion for temporary relief in the family file. The court thereafter held a hearing as required by statute. And the amended order for temporary relief provided for joint legal custody on the expiration of the stipulated OFP. So I don't know what evidence was produced at that family court hearing, but it seems like your client availed himself of another way to try to have custody and visitation with his children.
There was not an evidentiary hearing, so there were no credibility determinations made. And so here you have two narratives, and our client posits that consistent narrative, consistent with the facts, the spouse, Jennifer, inconsistent narrative, inconsistent with the facts. If we had gotten an evidentiary hearing, then we wouldn't have any complaints.
Unfortunately, your client waived the right to an evidentiary hearing when he signed the stipulation.
Understanding the law was, now understanding the law, that the law states that upon the extension, there will be a hearing with respect to this element. Are the children in reasonable fear of physical harm from the respondent?
Well, he was represented by a lawyer at the initial hearing.
I must be misunderstood here. There's two parties here that weren't represented. That was the two minor children, a 13 and 15-year-old. And that 13 and 15-year-old have rights under the statutes. My client is arguing that the 13 and 15-year-old have a right to a showing at that hearing with respect to whether they're in reasonable fear of physical harm from the respondent. And so I understand the court's concerns here about those contractual arguments and so forth, but the statute is intended to protect minor children. And how are we going to reject state legislative text that says this hearing has to occur because the minor children are protected persons and they are not represented, I would allege, in this proceeding, because they're under sole custody of the mother. The mother's attorney is representing the mother and the mother's interests. And it would appear to me that with the reference in the district court, this is routine, that this may be a routine way that lawyers experienced in the family law bar establish a way at the beginning to get an OFP extension without children who are protected parties in the OFP making a showing of reasonable fear of physical harm from the respondent at the time of the OFP extension. Now, I took me a long time to figure that out. A lot of fathers and others and mothers are not represented by attorneys who are going to understand that at the time you sign this, this means that the children, who may be under the sole custody of the mother, won't have to make a showing of reasonable fear of physical harm from the respondent. Now, we can go down this road and say the children don't get protected. We can say these settlement agreements are fine, but it is reasonable at the time of an OFP extension, when the court signs the OFP extension, that the consideration is made whether the children are still in fear of physical harm from the father, which is presenting the visitation. I think that's...
There was at least one instance during the existence of the stipulated OFP where the parties returned to the court and got the district court to change a provision, correct?
Yes.
Why can't they do that now? Why can't you make these same arguments now to the district court?
Well, in the first instance, you know, the state legislature doesn't require us to do it. There was a violation. Secondly,
not required, but it seems like if the issue is the extension of the OFP impairs, and I understand that that's the argument, impairs the father's rights to see his children and the children's right to see their father, why can't and shouldn't that first go to a fact-finding court?
That's what we were attempting to do. I mean, that was the purpose of the
motion. You can still do it now, can't you? You can make an application, even though there's an order to extend it. The terms within the order are subject to review by the district court, are they not?
A couple things. One is the burden shifts. So the person who's making the motion to extend the OFP, here the petitioner, she has the burden to show reasonable that the children have reasonable fear of physical harm from the respondent.
That's not that wouldn't not be what true. The agreement says.
That wouldn't be true in a subsequent proceeding to modify the agreement. The person proposing to modify the agreement would have these burdens, right?
Agreed.
So I think that, you know, I understand the court's points. I just want to, one last sentence. My principal plea to the court is that there's a third party purported beneficiary here, and that is the children. And the state legislature made a decision that with respect to OFP extensions, that there has to be a hearing. And I think they did it because they wanted to make sure, to the extent they could, that the courts are aware of this requirement that the children have to be benefited by the extension. Thank you.
Thank you. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you wish to use that time. Respondent.
May it please the court. I am Karen Linder, and I represent the respondent, Jennifer Gaughan. And rather than go through what's already in my brief in support of our argument that the court should affirm the district court, I would like to cover a couple of points, some of which the court has already started questioning the appellant's attorney about. I'd like to make clear, first of all, that in this case, the respondent is not arguing, as the appellant claims she is, that subdivision 6A does not apply because the court has subject matter jurisdiction. That's an argument that they made at their reply brief at page 1. The respondent is arguing that subdivision 6A does not apply because the parties bargained for and agreed on a different method to extend the stipulated order for protection for an additional year. As far as the burden shifting argument that appellant's attorney just made, there's a very simple cure for that. Don't stipulate to something that's going to shift the burden. In this case, appellant stipulated to that. And there is evidence in the file of the negotiations had between appellant's attorney and respondent's attorney at the time they were negotiating the terms of the stipulated order for protection. If they didn't have that agreement, then respondent would have had to follow the steps set out in subdivision 6A in order to get an extension. At the expiration of this 1 year extension, if she wants an additional extension, she will have to follow subdivision 6A. The reason that she doesn't have to follow it now is because the parties agreed to something else and the court approved that agreement. Appellant makes a lot of arguments about the strict construction of legislative limitations in various statutes. And he cites several cases. And these strict constructions of legislative limitations are specifically for bringing the action. In this case, the respondent did follow the strict limitations for bringing her original OFP. She filled out the petition and the affidavit for an order for protection. Notice was given to respondent. Respondent appeared. In fact, there were several hearings. It was continued several times to allow the parties to either prepare for the evidentiary hearing or to negotiate a settlement, which they eventually did. She did follow the strict construction. All the cases cited by appellant are cases that don't involve a stipulation, and they are at the outset of a case where the issue was, did the parties meet the statute of limitations? And other issues like that. In other words, could they even bring this case? Were they already too late in bringing the original action? It's clearly established law in Re LaBelle's Trust and the Anderson case that once an action has been properly brought, and there's no argument in this case from the appellant that respondent did not properly bring her action, once that action's been properly brought, the parties may bargain for and settle upon terms that the court could not order. And the parties in this case did exactly that. Not just paragraph 23, but they also agreed to provide for a parenting consultant to supervise the parenting time, I shouldn't say supervise, but to oversee the establishment of a parenting time schedule between appellant and the minor children and coordinate that with the children's therapists as well as the party's therapists. Now, unfortunately, that has not happened to date. Through no fault of respondent, she and the children are participating in that process, and I believe that there's evidence in the record in her three affidavits filed in this case that the reason that has not happened is because the appellant himself terminated the original family therapist back in October of 2018. And we have had to take time to get another family therapist on board, and in fact, that is happening now.
Do you agree that either party could return to the district court on these parenting time questions?
Yes.
There's nothing stopping the parties from having the district court address that in either this file or in the other file.
That's correct. So actually the logical extension of appellant's argument that the court has to have a hearing to extend an order for protection, irrespective of paragraph 23, is that the court would have to have a hearing in every case in order to establish or grant an OFP. The statute's very clear, and this is in subdivision 6, parens A, close parens. So it's different than the just 6A, but for the extension is 6A, the 6 parens A, close parens, is what the court can order on an original application for an order for protection. And that very clearly says that upon notice and hearing, the court can order these things. Well, clearly, we don't have an evidentiary hearing in every single domestic abuse case. The parties settle these cases quite frequently, and they do so by waiving their right to having a hearing. And just as in this case, the parties waived the right to have a hearing for the extension of the OFP one time. Because
I presume that you would, if we were to accept appellant's argument, I presume you would not want to be bound by all of the remaining terms of the stipulation. You'd want to return and see if you could get a finding of domestic abuse.
Well, yes, Your Honor. That would be the logical
Rather
conclusion
than
of that.
Rather than excise one little piece
right.
out.
Right. If a deal is a deal, and the entire deal has to stand. Otherwise, we're back to square one and we're back to relitigating the entire order for protection, which over, well, about a year and a half after the events, I don't think anyone is truly interested in doing. The appellant also argues that he's entitled to relief under Rule 60.02. He is not, because the trial court did not violate subdivision 6A regarding the extension. The trial court implemented the terms of the party's stipulation. Appellant had an opportunity for an evidentiary hearing in April of 2018. before he negotiated the terms of the stipulated OFP in paragraph 23. And the appellant, I'm sorry, the respondent, has not breached the stipulated order for protection, and the trial court specifically found that appellant had not established misconduct. Appellant has also had due process, as the court has already pointed out. He received notice. He could have had the evidentiary hearing in April of 2018. He did have a hearing in 2019 on his motion to vacate the extended order for protection and the court order extending it. And he's also had a temporary hearing in the legal separation proceeding on the issue of custody and parenting time. And unless the court has further questions of me, I will stand by the arguments in my brief and ask the court to affirm the trial court in all respects.
It appears we have none.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Cardle, you have 5 minutes if you wish to use that time.
Yes, Your Honor. The Minnesota I know doesn't cast aside children's rights cavalierly. The Minnesota I know is concerned about children, and particularly concerned about children having consistent relationships with both parents if possible. Here, the state legislature has, in the OFP precondition for an OFP extension, has said that there must be a showing of reasonable fear of physical harm from the respondent. That applies to children. So why wouldn't this court require a showing at the moment of the OFP extension when a father objects that there must be a showing of reasonable fear of physical harm from the respondent? This is completely inconsistent with how Minnesota legislature has dealt with children and parental rights. Now, I agree the family law bar has done a fantastic job of drafting this routine, according to court, provision that circumvents the OFP extension as I have described it. But the very purpose of paragraph 23 is to avoid, at the time of the extension, the children making a reasonable showing of physical harm from the respondent. That's how you get these kind of paragraphs drafted by a bar, a group of lawyers drafting and saying, how can the petitioner and OFP gain an advantage at the OFP extension? The advantage the family bar gets out of paragraph 23 is, at the time of the OFP extension, the petitioner does not need to show that the children are in reasonable fear of physical harm from the parent. This is not an onerous requirement. Even the statute says a petitioner does not need to show that physical harm is imminent to obtain an extension or a subsequent order under the subdivision. The difference between the OFP being in place and for 1 year and 2 years has significant effect on the children who are 13 and 15, and that means they may not be able to visit their father for another year. Having the children, either through therapists or directly testifying, whether they want to visit, communicate, and contact their other parent is reasonable. And we can disagree whether it's reasonable. Well, we can disagree all the way through Sunday that's unreasonable. But the state legislature decided. And so to disregard the state legislature's requirement under an onerous statute and to basically throw these children under the bus isn't fair. The children did not, these at the time probably 12 and 14-year-old children, did not negotiate the OFP settlement agreement. They did not negotiate every provision. They did not negotiate the term. And in these situations, the legislature said, well, let's have a showing that the children have reasonable fear of physical harm from the parent, here the father. So Mr. Gaughan just comes to you and says, well, why can't we hear from them? Why can't we hear from their therapist on whether they want to see the father, whether they want to communicate with the father by letter, by email, by Skype? I mean, there's no corroborating evidence in this case of these abuse allegations. There's no child protection investigation. And obviously there are extreme allegations made by Jennifer regarding Patrick, which we allege are not true. So if all these experts are available that my friend representing Mrs. Gaughan has said, then why can't they testify as to the harm? My concern, of course, is that this is all set up so they wouldn't have to express at the time of the OFP extension, the children wouldn't have to express fear, reasonable fear of harm from the father. And that can't be allowed. That's not what Minnesota's about. We can, again, disagree politically, but when the state legislature decides to protect children, then it's the appellate court's responsibility, I believe, to follow the state legislative intent. With respect to one point, can the state legislature restrict the courts? And Wagner, Miller v. Dahl, the Minnesota Supreme Court stated, where the cause of action did not exist at all under the common law, if the legislature determines that in the best interest of the state and consistent with public policy, such a cause of action should be created, the legislature clearly has the authority to set the conditions for bringing the action. I propose in this case that the OFP and the OFP extension were one cause of action. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. The matter is submitted, and we will issue our decision within 90 days as required by our rules. We thank counsel for your briefing and argument.